I want to know everything about you. Why don't you ask? You'll tell me when you want to. It doesn't matter much to you, does it? What? What I've been doing. Oh, yes, it does, Peter. No, not too much. That's sweet of you. But you see, it's not what you do that matters, really. It's only you. Me what? Just you here. Or you in the city. Or you somewhere in the world. I don't know. Just that. You know you're a fool, Katie. Your technique is something awful. My what? Your technique. You can't tell a man so shamelessly like that that you're practically crazy about him. But I am. But you can't say so. Men won't care for you. But I don't want men to care for me. You want me to, don't you? But you do, don't you? I do, he said, his arms tightening around her. Damnably. I'm a bigger fool than you are. Well, then it's perfectly all right, she said, her fingers in his hair. Isn't it? It's always been perfectly all right. That's the strangest part about it. But look, I want to tell you about what's happened to me, because it's important.
I'm really very interested, Peter.
Well, you know I'm working for Francona & Heyer, and... Oh, hell, you don't even know what that means.
Yes, I do. I've looked them up in Who's Who in Architecture. It said some very nice things about them. And I asked Uncle. He said they were tops in the business.
You bet they are. Francona, he's the greatest designer in New York, in the whole country, in the world, maybe. He's put up 17 skyscrapers, 8 cathedrals, 6 railroad terminals, and God knows what else. Of course, you know, he's an old fool and a pompous fraud who oils his way into everything, and... He stopped, his mouth open, staring at her. He had not intended to say that. He had never allowed himself to think that before. She was looking at him serenely.
Yes, she asked. And?
Well, and, he stammered, and he knew that he could not speak differently, not to her. And that's what I really think of him, and I have no respect for him at all. And I'm delighted to be working for him. See?
Sure, she said quietly. You're ambitious, Peter.
Don't you despise me for it?
No. That's what you wanted.
Sure, that's what I wanted. Well, actually, it's not as bad as that. It's a tremendous firm, the best in the city. I'm really doing work, and Francona is very pleased with me. I'm getting ahead. I think I can have any job I want in the place eventually. Why, only tonight I took over a man's work, and he doesn't know that he'll be useless soon, because... Katie, what am I saying?
It's all right, dear. I understand.
If you did, you'd call me the names I deserve and make me stop it.
No, Peter, I don't want to change you. I love you, Peter.
God help you.
I know that.
You know that? And you say it like this? Like you'd say, hello, it's a beautiful evening?
Well, why not? Why worry about it? I love you.
No, don't worry about it. Don't ever worry about it. Katie, I'll never love anyone else.
I know that, too.
He held her close, anxiously, afraid that her weightless little body would vanish. He did not know why her presence made him confess things unconfessed in his own mind. He did not know why the victory he came here to share had faded. But it did not matter. He had a peculiar sense of freedom. Her presence always lifted from him a pressure he could not define. He was alone. He was himself. All that mattered to him now was the feeling of her coarse cotton blouse against his wrist. Then he was asking her about her own life in New York, and she was speaking happily about her uncle.
He's wonderful, Peter. He's really wonderful. He's quite poor, but he took me in and he was so gracious about it. He gave up his study to make a room for me, and now he has to work here in the living room. You must meet him, Peter. He's away now on a lecture tour, but you must meet him when he comes back.
Sure, I'd love to.
You know, I wanted to go to work and be on my own, but he wouldn't let me.
My dear child, he said, not at 17. You don't want me to be ashamed of myself, do you? I don't believe in child labor.
That was kind of a funny idea, don't you think? He has so many funny ideas. I don't understand them all, but they say he's a brilliant man. So he made it look as if I were doing him a favor by letting him keep me. And I think that was really very decent of him.
What do you do with yourself all day long?
Nothing much of anything now. I read books on architecture. Uncle has tons of books on architecture. But when he's here, I type his lectures for him. I really don't think he likes me to do it. He prefers the typist he had, but I love it, and he lets me. And he pays me her salary. I didn't want to take it, but he made me.
What does he do for a living?
Oh, so many things. I don't know. I can't keep track of them. He teaches art history, for one thing. He's kind of professor.
And when are you going to college, by the way?
Oh, well, you see, I don't think Uncle approves of the idea. I told him how I'd always planned to go, and that I'd work my own way through, but he seems to think it's not for me. He doesn't say much, only God made the elephant for toil and the mosquito for flitting about, and it's not advisable as a rule to experiment with the laws of nature. However, if you want to try it, my dear child. But he's not objecting, really. It's up to me, only.
Well, don't let him stop you.
Oh, he wouldn't want to stop me. Only, I was thinking. I was never any great shakes in high school. And darling, I'm really quite utterly lousy at mathematics, and so I wonder. But then there's no hurry. I've got plenty of time to decide.
Listen, Katie, I don't like that. You've always planned on college. If that uncle of yours...
You shouldn't say it like this. You don't know him. He's the most amazing man. I've never met anyone quite like him. He's so kind, so understanding... And he's such fun, always joking. He's so clever at it. Nothing that you thought was serious ever seems to be when he's around, and yet he's a very serious man. You know, he spends hours talking to me. He's never too tired, and he's not bored with my stupidity. He tells me all about strikes and conditions in the slums and the poor people in sweatshops. Always about others, never about himself. A friend of his told me that Uncle could be a very rich man if he tried. He's so clever, but he won't. He just isn't interested in money.
That's not human.
Wait till you see him. Oh, he wants to meet you, too. I've told him about you. He calls you the T-Square Romeo.
Oh, he does he?
But you don't understand. He means it kindly. It's the way he says things. You'll have a lot in common. Maybe he could help you. He knows something about architecture, too. You'll love Uncle Ellsworth.
Who? Said Keating.
My uncle.
Say... Keating asked, his voice a little husky. What's your uncle's name?
Ellsworth Toohey. Why?
His hands fell limply. He sat staring at her.
What's the matter, Peter?
He swallowed. He saw the jerking motion of his throat. Then he said, his voice hard, Listen, Katie, I don't want to meet your uncle.
But why?
I don't want to meet him. Not through you. You see, Katie, you don't know me. I'm the kind that uses people. I don't want to use you, ever. Don't let me. Not you.
Use me how? What's the matter? Why?
This. I'd give my eye teeth to meet Ellsworth Toohey, that's all. He laughed harshly. So he knows something about architecture, does he? You little fool. He's the most important man in architecture. Not yet, maybe, but that's what'll be in a couple of years. Ask Francone, that old weasel knows. He's on his way to becoming the Napoleon of all architectural critics, your Uncle Ellsworth is. Just watch him. In the first place, there aren't many to bother writing about our profession, so he's the smart boy who's going to corner the market. You should see the big shots in our office lapping up every comma he puts out in print. So you think maybe he could help me? Well, he could make me, and he will. And I'm going to meet him someday, when I'm ready for him, as I met Francone. But not here, not through you. Understand? Not from you.
But, Peter, why not?
Because I don't want it that way. Because it's filthy, and I hate it. All of it, my work and my profession and what I'm doing and what I'm going to do. It's something I want to keep you out of. You're all I really have. Just keep out of it, Katie.
Out of what?
I don't know. She rose and stood in the circle of his arms, his face hidden against her hip. She stroked his hair, looking down at him.
All right, Peter. I think I know. You don't have to meet him until you want to. Just tell me when you want it. You can use me if you have to. It's all right. It won't change anything.
When he raised his head, she was laughing softly.
You've worked too hard, Peter. You're a little unstrung.
Suppose I make you some tea?
Oh, I'd forgotten all about it, but I've had no dinner today, had no time.
Well, of all things, well, how perfectly disgusting. Come on to the kitchen this minute. I'll see what I can fix up for you.
He left her 2 hours later, and he walked away feeling light, clean, happy, his fears forgotten, Tui and Francone forgotten. He thought only that he had promised to come again tomorrow, and that it was an unbearably long time to wait. She stood at the door after he had gone, her hand on the knob he had touched, and she thought that he might come tomorrow. Or 3 months later.
"When you finish tonight," said Henry Cameron, "I want to see you in my office."
"Yes," said Rourke. Cameron veered sharply on his heels and walked out of the drafting room. It had been the longest sentence he had addressed to Rourke in a month. Rourke had come to this room every morning, had done his task, and had heard no word of comment. Cameron would enter the drafting room and stand behind Rourke for a long time, looking over his shoulder. It was as if his eyes concentrated deliberately on trying to throw the steady hand off its course on the paper. The two other draftsmen botched their work from the mere thought of such an apparition standing behind them. Rourke did not seem to notice it. He went on, his hand unhurried. He took his time about discarding a blunted pencil and picking out another.
"Uh-huh,"
Cameron would grunt suddenly. Rourke would turn his head then, politely attentive.
"What is it?" he would ask.
Cameron would turn away without a word, his narrowed eyes underscoring contemptuously the fact that he considered an answer unnecessary, and would leave the drafting room. Rourke would go on with his drafting.
"Looks bad," Loomis, the young draftsman, confided to Simpson, his ancient colleague. "The old man doesn't like this guy. Can't say that I blame him either. Here's one that won't last long."
Simpson was old and helpless. He had survived from Cameron's three-floor office, had stuck, and had never understood it. Loomis was young, with the face of a drugstore corner lout. He was here because he had been fired from too many other places. Both men disliked Rourke. He was usually disliked from the first sight of his face anywhere he went. His face was closed, like the door of a safety vault. Things locked in safety vaults are valuable. Men did not care to feel that. He was a cold, disquieting presence in the room. His presence had a strange quality. It made itself felt, and yet it made them feel that he was not there. Or perhaps that he was, and they weren't. After work, he walked the long distance to his home, a tenement near the East River. He had chosen that tenement because he had been able to get for $2.50 a week its entire top floor, a huge room that had been used for storage. It had no ceiling, and the roof leaked between its naked beams, but it had a long row of windows along two of its walls, some panes filled with glass, others with cardboard, and the windows opened high over the river on one side, and the city on the other. A week ago, Cameron had come into the drafting room and had thrown down on Rourke's table a violent sketch of a country residence.
"See if you can make a house out of this," he had snapped,
and gone without further explanation. He had not approached Rourke's table during the days that followed. Rourke had finished the drawings last night and left them on Cameron's desk. This morning, Cameron had come in, thrown some sketches of steel joints to Rourke, ordered him to appear in his office later, and had not entered the drafting room again for the rest of the day. The others were gone. Rourke pulled an old piece of oilcloth over his table and went to Cameron's office. His drawings of the country house were spread on the desk. The light of the lamp fell on Cameron's cheek, on his beard, the white threads glistening, on his fist, on a corner of the drawing, its black lines bright and hard, as if embossed on the paper.
"You're fired," said Cameron.
Rourke stood halfway across the long room, his weight on one leg, his arms hanging by his sides, one shoulder raised.
"Am I?" he asked quietly, without moving. "Come here," said Cameron. "Sit down."
Rourke obeyed.
"You're too good," said Cameron. "You're too good for what you want to do with yourself. It's no use, Rourke. Better now than later."
"What do you mean?" It's no use wasting what you've got on an ideal that you'll never reach, that they'll never let you reach. It's no use taking that marvelous thing you have and making a torture rack for yourself out of it. Sell it, Rourke. Sell it now. It won't be the same, but you've got enough in you. You've got what they'll pay you for, and pay plenty if you use it their way. Accept them, Rourke. Compromise. Compromise now, because you'll have to later anyway. Only then you'll have gone through things you'll wish you hadn't. You don't know. I do. Save yourself from that. Leave me. Go to someone else.
Did you do that?
You presumptuous bastard! How good do you think I said you were? Did I tell you to compare yourself to—
He stopped, because he saw that Rourke was smiling. He looked at Rourke, and suddenly smiled in answer. And it was the most painful thing that Rourke had ever seen.
No, said Cameron softly. That won't work, huh?
No, it won't.
Well, you're right. You're as good as you think you are. But I want to speak to you. I don't know exactly how to go about it. I've lost the habit of speaking to men like you. Lost it? Maybe I've never had it. Maybe that's what frightens me now. Will you try to understand?
I understand. I think you're wasting your time.
Don't be rude, because I can't be rude to you now. I want you to listen. Will you listen and not answer me?
Yes, I'm sorry. I didn't intend it as rudeness.
You see, of all men, I'm the last one to whom you should have come. I'll be committing a crime if I keep you here. Somebody should have warned you against me. I won't help you at all. I won't discourage you. I won't teach you any common sense. Instead, I'll push you on. I'll drive you the way you're going now. I'll beat you into remaining what you are, and I'll make you worse. Don't you see? In another month, I won't be able to let you go. I'm not sure I can now. So don't argue with me, and go. Get out while you can.
But can I? Don't you think it's too late for both of us? It was too late for me 12 years ago.
Try it, Rourke. Try to be reasonable for once. There's plenty of big fellows who'll take you, expulsion or no expulsion, if I say so. They may laugh at me in their luncheon speeches, but they steal from me when it suits them. And they know that I know a good draftsman when I see one. I'll give you a letter to Guy Francone. He worked for me once, long ago. I think I fired him, but that wouldn't matter. Go to him. You won't like it at first, but you'll get used to it. And you'll thank me for it many years from now.
Why are you saying all this to me? That's not what you want to say. That's not what you did.
That's why I'm saying it, because that's not what I did.
Look, Rourke. There's one thing about you, the thing I'm afraid of. It's not just the kind of work you do. I wouldn't care if you were an exhibitionist who's being different as a stunt, as a lark, just to attract attention to himself. It's a smart racket to oppose the crowd and amuse it and collect admission to the sideshow. If you did that, I wouldn't worry. But it's not that. You love your work. God help you, you love it. And that's the curse. That's the brand on your forehead for all of them to see. You love it, and they know it, and they know they have you. Do you ever look at the people in the street? Aren't you afraid of them?
I am. They move past you, and they wear hats, and they carry bundles. But that's not the substance of them. The substance of them is hatred for any man who loves his work. That's the only kind they fear. I don't know why. You're opening yourself up, Rourke, for each and every one of them.
But I never notice the people in the streets.
Do you notice what they've done to me?
I notice only that you weren't afraid of them.
Why do you ask me to be? That's just why I'm asking it.
He leaned forward, his fists closing on the desk before him.
Rourke, do you want me to say it? You're cruel, aren't you? All right, I'll say it. Do you want to end up like this? Do you want to be what I am?
Rourke got up and stood against the edge of light on the desk. If, said Rourke, at the end of my life I'll be what you are today, here in this office, I shall consider it an honor that I could not have deserved.
Sit down, roared Cameron. I don't like demonstrations.
Rourke looked down at himself, at the desk, astonished to find himself standing.
He said, "I'm sorry. I didn't know I got up."
"Well, sit down. Listen, I understand, and it's very nice of you. But you don't know. I thought a few days here would be enough to take the hero worship out of you. I see I wasn't. Here you are saying to yourself how grand old Cameron is, a noble fighter, a martyr to a lost cause, and you'd just love to die on the barricades with me and to eat and dine lunch wagons with me for the rest of your life. I know it looks pure and beautiful to you now at your great old age of 22. But do you know what it means? 30 years of a lost cause? That sounds beautiful, doesn't it? But do you know how many days there are in 30 years? Do you know what happens in those days? Rourke, do you know what happens?"
"You don't want to speak of that."
"No, I don't want to speak of that, but I'm going to. I want you to hear. I want you to know what's in store for you. There will be days when you look at your hands and you want to take something and smash every bone in them because they'll be taunting you with what they could do, if you found a chance for them to do it. And you can't find that chance, and you can't bear your living body because it has failed those hands somewhere. There will be days when a bus driver will snap at you as you enter a bus, and he'll be only asking for a dime, but that won't be what you'll hear. You'll hear that you're nothing, that he's laughing on you, that it's written on your forehead, that thing they hate you for. There will be days when you'll stand in the corner of a hall and listen to a creature on a platform talking about buildings, about that work which you love, and the things he'll say will make you wait for somebody to rise and crack him open between two thumbnails. And then you'll hear the people applauding him, and you'll want to scream because you won't know whether they're real or you are, whether you're in a room full of gourd skulls or whether someone has just emptied your own head. And you'll say nothing, because the sounds you could make, they're not a language in that room any longer. But if you'd want to speak, you won't anyway, because you'll be brushed aside, you who have nothing to tell them about buildings. Is that what you want?"
Rourke sat still, the shadows sharp on his face, a black wedge on a sunken cheek, a long triangle of black cutting across his chin, his eyes on Cameron.
"Not enough?" asked Cameron. "All right. Then one day you'll see on a piece of paper before you a building that'll make you want to kneel. You won't believe that you've done it, but you will have done it. Then you'll think that the earth is beautiful, and the air smells of spring, and you love your fellow men because there is no evil in the world. And you'll set out from your house with this drawing to have it erected, because you won't have any doubt that it will be erected by the first man to see it. But you won't get very far from your house, because you'll be stopped at the door by the man who's come to turn off the gas. You hadn't had much food, because you saved money to finish your drawing, but still you had to cook something, and you hadn't paid for it. All right, that's nothing. You can laugh at that. But finally, you'll get into a man's office with your drawing, and you'll curse yourself for taking so much space of his air with your body, and you'll try to squeeze yourself out of his sight so that he won't see you, but only hear your voice begging him, pleading, your voice licking his knees. You'll loathe yourself for it, but you won't care if only he'd let you put up that building. You won't care. You'll want to rip your insides open to show him, because if he saw what's there, he'd have to let you put it up. But he'll say that he's very sorry, only the commission has just been given to Guy Francone. And you'll go home, and do you know what you'll do there? You'll cry. You'll cry like a woman, like a drunkard, like an animal. That's your future, Howard Rourke. Now, do you want it?"
"Yes," said Rourke. Cameron's eyes dropped. Then his head moved down a little, then a little farther. His head went on dropping slowly, in long single jerks, then stopped. He sat still, his shoulders hunched, his arms huddled together in his lap.
"Howard," whispered Cameron, "I've never told it to anyone."
"Thank you," said Rourke. After a long time, Cameron raised his head. "Go home now," said Cameron, his voice flat. "You've worked too much lately, and you have a hard day ahead." He pointed to the drawings of the country house. "This is all very well, and I wanted to see what you'd do, but it's not good enough to build. You'll have to do it over. I'll show you what I want tomorrow." Chapter 5 A year with the firm of Francone and Hire had given Keating the whispered title of Crown Prince without portfolio. Still only a draftsman, he was Francone's reigning favorite. Francone took him out to lunch, an unprecedented honor for an employee. Francone called him to be present at interviews with clients. The client seemed to like seeing so decorative a young man in an architect's office. Lucius Enheyer had the annoying habit of asking Francone suddenly, "When did you get the new man?" and pointing to an employee who had been there for 3 years. But Heyer surprised everybody by remembering Keating's name and by greeting him whenever they met with a smile of positive recognition. Keating had had a long conversation with him one dreary November afternoon on the subject of old porcelain. It was Heyer's hobby. He owned a famous collection, passionately gathered. Keating displayed an earnest knowledge of the subject, though he had never heard of old porcelain till the night before, which he had spent at the public library. Heyer was delighted. Nobody in the office cared about his hobby. Few ever noticed his presence. Heyer remarked to his partner, "You're certainly good at picking your men, Guy. There's one boy I wish we wouldn't lose. What's his name?" "Keating."
"Yes, indeed," Francone answered, smiling. "Yes, indeed."
In the drafting room, Keating concentrated on Tim Davis. Work and drawings were only unavoidable details on the surface of his days. Tim Davis was the substance and the shape of the first step in his career. Davis let him do most of his own work, only night work at first, then parts of his daily assignments as well, secretly at first, then openly. Davis had not wanted it to be known. Keating made it known, with an air of naive confidence which implied that he was only a tool, no more than Tim's pencil or T-square, that his help enhanced Tim's importance rather than diminished it, and therefore he did not wish to conceal it. At first, Davis relayed instructions to Keating. Then the chief draftsman took the arrangement for granted and began coming to Keating with orders intended for Davis. Keating was always there, smiling, saying, "I'll do it. Don't bother Tim with those little things. I'll take care of it." Davis relaxed and let himself be carried along. He smoked a great deal. He lolled about, his legs twisted loosely over the rungs of a stool, his eyes closed, dreaming of Elaine. He uttered once in a while, "Is the stuff ready, Pete?" Davis had married Elaine that spring. He was frequently late for work. He had whispered to Keating, "You're in with the old man, Pete. Slip a good word for me once in a while, will you? So they'll overlook a few things. God, do I hate to have to be working right now." Keating would say to Francone, "I'm sorry, Mr. Francone, that the Murray job sub-basement plans were so late. But Tim Davis had a quarrel with his wife last night, and you know how newlyweds are. You don't want to be too hard on them." Or, "It's Tim Davis again, Mr. Francone. Do forgive him, he can't help it. He hasn't got his mind on his work at all." When Francone glanced at the list of his employees' salaries, he noticed that his most expensive draftsman was the man least needed in the office. When Tim Davis lost his job, no one in the drafting room was surprised, but Tim Davis. He could not understand it. He set his lips defiantly in bitterness against a world he would hate forever. He felt that he had no friend on earth save Peter Keating. Keating consoled him, cursed Francone, cursed the injustice of humanity, spent $6 in a speakeasy entertaining the secretary of an obscure architect of his acquaintance, and arranged a new job for Tim Davis. Whenever he thought of Davis afterward, Keating felt a warm pleasure. He had influenced the course of a human being, had thrown him off one path and pushed him into another. A human being, it was not Tim Davis to him any longer, it was a living frame and a mind, a conscious mind. Why had he always feared that mysterious entity of consciousness within others? And he had twisted that frame and that mind to his own will. By a unanimous decision of Francone, Heyer, and the chief draftsman, Tim's table, position, and salary were given to Peter Keating. But this was only part of his satisfaction. There was another sense of it, warmer and less real, and more dangerous. He said brightly and often, "Tim Davis? Oh, yes, I got him his present job." He wrote to his mother about it. She said to her friends, "Petey is such an unselfish boy." He wrote to her dutifully each week. His letters were short and respectful. Hers, long, detailed, and full of advice which he seldom finished reading. He saw Catherine Halsey occasionally. He had not gone to her on that following evening, as he had promised. He had awakened in the morning, and remembered the things he had said to her, and hated her for his having said them. But he had gone to her again a week later. She had not reproached him, and they had not mentioned her uncle. He saw her after that every month or two. He was happy when he saw her, but he never spoke to her of his career. He tried to speak of it to Howard Rourke. The attempt failed. He called on Rourke twice. He climbed indignantly the 5 flights of stairs to Rourke's room. He greeted Rourke eagerly. He waited for reassurance, not knowing what sort of reassurance he needed, nor why it could come only from Rourke. He spoke of his job, and he questioned Rourke with sincere concern about Cameron's office. Rourke listened to him, answered all his questions willingly, but Keating felt that he was knocking against a sheet of iron in Rourke's unmoving eyes, and that they were not speaking about the same things at all. Before the visit was over, Keating was taking notice of Rourke's frayed cuffs, of his shoes, of the patch on the knee of his trousers, and he felt satisfied. He went away chuckling, but he went away miserably uneasy, and wondered why, and swore never to see Rourke again, and wondered why he knew that he would have to see him. "Well," said Keating, "I couldn't quite work it to ask her to lunch, but she's coming to Mawson's exhibition with me day after tomorrow. Now what?" He sat on the floor, his head resting against the edge of a couch, his bare feet stretched out, a pair of Guy Francon's chartreuse pajamas floating loosely about his limbs. Through the open door of the bathroom, he saw Francon standing at the washstand, his stomach pressed to its shining edge, brushing his teeth.
"That's splendid," said Francon, munching through a thick foam of toothpaste. "That'll do just as well. Don't you see?"
"No."
"Lord, Pete, I explained it to you yesterday before we started. Mrs. Dunlop's husband's planning to build a home for her."
"Oh, yeah," said Keating weakly, brushing the matted black curls off his face. "Oh, yeah, I remember now. Jesus, Gee, I got a head on me."
He remembered vaguely the party to which Francon had taken him the night before. He remembered the caviar in a hollow iceberg, the black net evening gown and the pretty face of Mrs. Dunlop. But he could not remember how he had come to end up in Francon's apartment. He shrugged. He had attended many parties with Francon in the past year, and had often been brought here like this. "It's not a very large house," Francon was saying, holding the toothbrush in his mouth. It made a lump on his cheek, and its green handle stuck out. 50,000 or so, I understand. They're small fry, anyway. But Mrs. Dunlop's brother-in-law is Quimby. You know, the big real estate fellow. Won't hurt to get a little wedge into that family, won't hurt at all. You're to see where that commission ends up, Pete. Can I count on you, Pete?"
"Sure," said Keating, his head drooping. "You can always count on me, Guy."
He sat still, watching his bare toes, and thinking of Stengel, Francon's designer. He did not want to think, but his mind leaped to Stengel automatically, as it always did, because Stengel represented his next step. Stengel was impregnable to friendship. For 2 years, Keating's attempts had broken against the ice of Stengel's glasses. What Stengel thought of him was whispered in the drafting rooms, but few dared to repeat it save in quotes. Stengel said it aloud, even though he knew that the corrections his sketches bore, when they returned to him from Francon's office, were made by Keating's hand. But Stengel had a vulnerable point. He had been planning for some time to leave Francon and open an office of his own. He had selected a partner, a young architect of no talent, but of great inherited wealth. Stengel was waiting only for a chance. Keating had thought about this a great deal. He could think of nothing else. He thought of it again, sitting there on the floor of Francon's bedroom. 2 days later, when he escorted Mrs. Dunlop through the gallery, exhibiting the paintings of one Frederick Mawson, his course of action was set. He piloted her through the sparse crowd, his fingers closing over her elbow once in a while, letting her catch his eyes directed at her young face more often than at the paintings. Yes, he said, as she stared obediently at a landscape, featuring an auto dump, and tried to compose her face into the look of admiration expected of her. Magnificent work. Note the colors, Mrs. Dunlop. They say this fellow Mawson had a terribly hard time. It's an old story, trying to get recognition. Old and heartbreaking. It's the same in all the arts, my own profession included.
Oh, indeed, said Mrs. Dunlop, who quite seemed to prefer architecture at the moment.
Now this, said Keating, stopping before the depiction of an old hag picking at her bare toes on a street curb. This is art as a social document. It takes a person of courage to appreciate this.
It's simply wonderful, said Mrs. Dunlop.
Ah, yes, courage. It's a rare quality. They say Mawson was starving in a garret when Mrs. Stuyvesant discovered him. It's glorious to be able to help young talent on its way.
It must be wonderful, agreed Mrs. Dunlop.
If I were rich, said Keating wistfully, I'd make it my hobby. To arrange an exhibition for a new artist, to finance the concert of a new pianist, to have a house built by a new architect.
Do you know, Mr. Keating, my husband and I are planning to build a little home on Long Island.
Oh, are you? How very charming of you, Mrs. Dunlop, to confess such a thing to me. You're so young, if you'll forgive me saying this. Don't you know that you run the danger of my becoming a nuisance and trying to interest you in my firm? Or are you safe and have chosen an architect already?
No, I'm not safe at all, said Mrs. Dunlop, prettily. And I wouldn't mind the danger, really. I've thought a great deal about the firm of Francone and Hire in these last few days, and I've heard they are so terribly good.
Well, thank you, Mrs. Dunlop. Mr. Francone is a great architect.
Oh, yes. What's the matter?
Nothing. Nothing, really.
No, what's the matter?
Do you really want me to tell you?
Why, certainly.
Well, you see, Guy Francone, it's only a name. He would have nothing to do with your house. It's one of those professional secrets that I shouldn't divulge. But I don't know what it is about you that makes me want to be honest. All the best buildings in our office are designed by Mr. Stengel.
Who?
Claude Stengel. You've never heard the name, but you will, when someone has the courage to discover him. You see, he does all the work. He's the real genius behind the scenes. But Francone puts his signature on it and gets all the credit. That's the way it's done everywhere.
But why does Mr. Stengel stand for it?
What can he do? No one will give him a start. You know how most people are. They stick to the beaten path. They pay three times the price for the same thing just to have the trademark. Courage, Mrs. Dunlop. They lack courage. Stengel is a great artist, but there's so few discerning people to see it. He's ready to go on his own if only he could find some outstanding person like Mrs. Stuyvesant to give him a chance.
Really? Said Mrs. Dunlop. How very interesting. Tell me more about it.
He told her a great deal more about it. By the time they had finished the inspection of the works of Frederick Mawson, Mrs. Dunlop was shaking Keating's hand and saying,
It's so kind, so very unusually kind of you. Are you sure that it won't embarrass you with your office if you arrange for me to meet Mr. Stengel? I didn't quite dare to suggest it, and it was so kind of you not to be angry at me. It's so unselfish of you, and more than anyone else would have done in your position.
When Keating approached Stengel with the suggestion of a proposed luncheon, the man listened to him without a word. Then he jerked his head and snapped,
What's in it for you?
Before Keating could answer, Stengel threw his head back suddenly.
Oh, said Stengel. Oh, I see.
Then he leaned forward, his mouth drawn thin in contempt.
Okay. I'll go to that lunch.
When Stengel left the firm of Francone and Hire to open his own office and proceed with the construction of the Dunlop House, his first commission, Guy Francone smashed a ruler against the edge of his desk and roared to Keating,
The bastard! The abysmal bastard! After all I've done for him!
What did you expect? Said Keating, sprawled in a low armchair before him. Such is life.
But what beats me is how did that little skunk ever hear of it? To snatch it right from under our nose.
Well, I've never trusted him anyway. Keating shrugged.
Human nature.
The bitterness in his voice was sincere. He had received no gratitude from Stengel. Stengel's parting remark to him had been only,
"You're a worse bastard than I thought you were. Good luck. You'll be a great architect someday."
Thus, Keating achieved the position of chief designer for Francone and Heyer. Francone celebrated the occasion with a modest little orgy at one of the quieter and costlier restaurants.
"In a couple of years," he kept repeating, "in a couple of years you'll see things happening, Pete. You're a good boy and I like you and I'll do things for you. Haven't I done things for you? You're going places, Pete. In a couple of years."
"Your tie's crooked, Gee," said Keating dryly. "And you're spilling brandy all over your vest." Facing his first task of designing, Keating thought of Tim Davis, of Stengel, of many others who had wanted it, had struggled for it, had tried, had been beaten. By him. It was a triumphant feeling. It was a tangible affirmation of his greatness. Then he found himself suddenly in his glass-enclosed office, looking down at a blank sheet of paper. Alone. Something rolled in his throat down to his stomach, cold and empty. His old feeling of the dropping hole. He leaned against the table, closing his eyes. It had never been quite real to him before that this was the thing actually expected of him. To fill a sheet of paper. To create something on a sheet of paper. It was only a small residence, but instead of seeing it rise before him, he saw it sinking. He saw its shape as a pit in the ground, and as a pit within him. As emptiness, with only Davis and Stengel rattling uselessly within it. Francone had said to him about the building, "It must have dignity, you know? Dignity, nothing freaky. A structure of elegance. And stay within the budget." Which was Francone's conception of giving his designer ideas and letting him work them out. Through a cold stupor, Keating thought of the clients laughing in his face. He heard the thin, omnipotent voice of Ellsworth Toohey calling his attention to the opportunities open to him in the field of plumbing. He hated every piece of stone on the face of the earth. He hated himself for having chosen to be an architect. When he began to draw, he tried not to think of the job he was doing. He thought only that Francone had done it, and Stengel, even Heyer, and all the others, and that he could do it, if they could. He spent many days on his preliminary sketches. He spent long hours in the library of Francone and Heyer, selecting from classic photographs the appearance of his house. He felt the tension melting in his mind. It was right, and it was good, that house growing under his hand, because men were still worshipping the masters who had done it before him. He did not have to wonder, to fear, or to take chances. It had been done for him. When the drawings were ready, he stood looking at them uncertainly. Were he to be told that this was the best or the ugliest house in the world, he would agree with either. He was not sure. He had to be sure. He thought of Stanton and of what he had relied upon when working on his assignments there. He telephoned Cameron's office and asked for Howard Rourke. He came to Rourke's room that night and spread before him the plans, the elevations, the perspective of his first building. Rourke stood over it, his arms spread wide, his hands holding the edge of the table, and he said nothing for a long time. Keating waited anxiously. He felt anger growing with his anxiety, because he could see no reason for being so anxious. When he couldn't stand it, he spoke. "You know, Howard, everybody says Stengel's the best designer in town. And I don't think he was really ready to quit. But I made him, and I took his place. I had to do some pretty fine thinking to work that. He stopped. It did not sound bright and proud as it would have sounded anywhere else. It sounded like begging. Rourke turned and looked at him. Rourke's eyes were not contemptuous, only a little wider than usual, attentive and puzzled. He said nothing and turned back to the drawings. Keating felt naked. Davis, Stengel, Francone meant nothing here. People were his protection against people. Rourke had no sense of people. Others gave Keating a feeling of his own value. Rourke gave him nothing. He thought that he should seize his drawings and run. The danger was not Rourke. The danger was that he, Keating, remained. Rourke turned to him.
"Do you enjoy doing this sort of thing, Peter?" he asked.
"Oh, I know," said Keating, his voice shrill. "I know you don't approve of it, but this is business. I just want to know what you think of this practically, not philosophically, not—"
"No, I'm not going to preach to you. I was only wondering.
If you could help me, Howard, if you could just help me with it a little. It's my first house, and it means so much to me at the office, and I'm not sure. What do you think? Will you help me, Howard?"
"All right."
Rourke threw aside the sketch of the graceful facade with the fluted pilasters, the broken pediments, the Roman fasces over the windows, and the two eagles of empire by the entrance. He picked up the plans. He took a sheet of tracing paper, threw it over the plan, and began to draw. Keating stood watching the pencil in Rourke's hand. He saw his imposing entrance foyer disappearing, his twisted corridors, his lightless corners. He saw an immense living room growing in the space he had thought too limited, a wall of giant windows facing the garden, a spacious kitchen. He watched for a long time. "And the facade?" he asked, when Rourke threw the pencil down.
"I can't help you with that. If you must have it classic, have it good classic, at least. You don't need three pilasters where one will do. And take those ducks off the door. It's too much."
Keating smiled at him gratefully when he was leaving, his drawings under his arm. He descended the stairs, hurt and angry. He worked for 3 days, making new plans from Rourke's sketches, and a new, simpler elevation, and he presented his house to Francone with a proud gesture that looked like a flourish.
"Well," said Francone, studying it. "Well, I declare. What an imagination you have, Peter. I wonder... It's a bit daring, but... I wonder..."
He coughed and added,
"It's just what I had in mind."
"Of course," said Keating. "I studied your buildings, and I tried to think of what you'd do. And if it's good, it's because I think I know how to catch your ideas." Francone smiled, and Keating thought suddenly that Francone did not really believe it, and knew that Keating did not believe it, and yet they were both contented, bound tighter together by a common method and a common guilt. The letter on Cameron's desk informed him regretfully that after earnest consideration, the board of directors of the Security Trust Company had not been able to accept his plans for the building to house the new Astoria branch of the company, and that the commission had been awarded to the firm of Gould and Pettingill. A check was attached to the letter in payment for his preliminary drawings, as agreed. The amount was not enough to cover the expense of making those drawings. The letter lay spread out on the desk. Cameron sat before it, drawn back, not touching the desk, his hands gathered in his lap, the back of one and the palm of the other, the fingers tight. It was only a small piece of paper, but he sat huddled and still because it seemed to be a supernatural thing, like radium, sending forth rays that would hurt him if he moved and exposed his skin to them. For 3 months he had awaited the commission of the Security Trust Company. One after another, the chances that had loomed before him at rare intervals in the last 2 years had vanished, looming in vague promises, vanishing in firm refusals. One of his draftsmen had had to be discharged long ago. The landlord had asked questions, politely at first, then dryly, then rudely and openly. But no one in the office had minded that, nor the usual arrears in salaries. There had been the commission of the Security Trust Company. The vice president, who had asked Cameron to submit drawings, had said, "I know some of the directors won't see it as I do, but go ahead, Mr. Cameron. Take the chance with me, and I'll fight for you." Cameron had taken the chance. He and Rourke had worked savagely to have the plans ready on time, before Gould and Pettingill could submit theirs. Pettingill was a cousin of the bank president's wife and a famous authority on the ruins of Pompeii. The bank president was an ardent admirer of Julius Caesar, and had once, while in Rome, spent an hour and a quarter in reverent inspection of the Colosseum. Cameron and Rourke and a pot of black coffee had lived in the office from dawn till frozen dawn for many days, and Cameron had thought involuntarily of the electric bill, but made himself forget it. The light still burned in the drafting room in the early hours when he sent Rourke out for sandwiches, and Rourke found gray morning in the streets while it was still night in the office, in the windows facing a high brick wall. On the last day, it was Rourke who had ordered Cameron home after midnight because Cameron's hands were jerking and his knees kept seeking the tall drafting stool for support, leaning against it with a slow, cautious, sickening precision. Rourke had taken him down to a taxi, and in the light of a street lamp, Cameron had seen Rourke's face, drawn, the eyes kept wide artificially, the lips dry. The next morning, Cameron had entered the drafting room and found the coffee pot on the floor, on its side over a black puddle, and Rourke's hand in the puddle, palm up, fingers half closed. Rourke's body stretched out on the floor, his head thrown back, fast asleep. On the table, Cameron had found the plans. Finished. He sat looking at the letter on his desk. The degradation was that he could not think of those nights behind him. He could not think of the building that should have risen in Astoria, and of the building that would now take its place. It was that he thought only of the bill, unpaid, to the electric company. In these last 2 years, Cameron had disappeared from his office for weeks at a time, and Rourke had not found him at home, and had known what was happening, but could only wait, hoping for Cameron's safe return. Then Cameron had lost even the shame of his agony, and had come to his office reeling, recognizing no one, openly drunk and flaunting it before the walls of the only place on earth he had respected. Rourke learned to face his own landlord with the quiet statement that he could not pay him for another week. The landlord was afraid of him and did not insist. He came to Rourke's unheated room one evening and sat down, keeping his overcoat on. He produced a wallet, pulled out 5 $10 bills, and handed them to Rourke. "You need it, Howard. I know you need it. Don't start protesting now. You can pay me back any time." Rourke looked at him, astonished, took the money, saying, "Yes, I need it. Thank you, Peter." Then Keating said, "What in hell are you doing wasting yourself on old Cameron? Why do you want to live like this for? Chuck it, Howard, and come with us. All I have to do is say so. Francone will be delighted. We'll start you at 60 a week." Rourke took the money out of his pocket and handed it back to him. "Oh, for God's sake, Howard, I didn't mean to offend you."
"I didn't either."
"But please, Howard, keep it anyway."
"Good night, Peter."
Rourke was thinking of that when Cameron entered the drafting room, the letter from the Security Trust Company in his hand. He gave the letter to Rourke, said nothing, turned and walked back to his office. Rourke read the letter and followed him. Whenever they lost another commission, Rourke knew that Cameron wanted to see him in the office, but not to speak of it. Just to see him there, to talk of other things, to lean upon the reassurance of his presence. On Cameron's desk, Rourke saw a copy of the New York Banner. It was the leading newspaper of the great Winand chain. It was a paper he would have expected to find in a kitchen, in a barber shop, in a third-rate drawing room, in the subway. Anywhere but in Cameron's office. Cameron saw him looking at it and grinned. "Picked it up this morning on my way here. Funny, isn't it? I didn't know we'd get that letter today, and yet it seems appropriate together, this paper and that letter. Don't know what made me buy it. A sense of symbolism, I suppose. Look at it, Howard. It's interesting." Rourke glanced through the paper. The front page carried the picture of an unwed mother with thick, glistening lips who had shot her lover. The picture headed the first installment of her autobiography and a detailed account of her trial. The other pages ran a crusade against utility companies, a daily horoscope, extracts from church sermons, recipes for young brides, pictures of girls with beautiful legs, advice on how to hold a husband, a baby contest, a poem proclaiming that to wash dishes was nobler than to write a symphony, an article proving that a woman who had borne a child was automatically a saint.
"That's our answer, Howard. That's the answer given to you and to me, this paper. That it exists, and that it's liked. Can you fight that? Have you any words to be heard and understood by that? They shouldn't have sent us the letter. They should have sent a copy of Winand's Banner. It would be simpler and clearer. Do you know that in a few years that incredible bastard, Gail Winand, will rule the world? It will be a beautiful world, and perhaps he's right.
Cameron held the paper outstretched, weighing it on the palm of his hand.
To give them what they want, Howard, and to let them worship you for it, for licking their feet. Or what? What's the use? Only it doesn't matter. Nothing matters. Not even that it doesn't matter to me anymore.
Then he looked at Rourke. He added,
If only I could hold on until I've started you on your own, Howard.
Don't speak of that.
I want to speak of that. It's funny, Howard. Next spring, it will be 3 years that you've been here. Seems so much longer, doesn't it? Well, have I taught you anything? I'll tell you. I've taught you a great deal, and nothing. No one can teach you anything, not at the core, at the source of it. What you're doing, it's yours, not mine. I can only teach you to do it better. I can give you the means, but the aim's your own. You won't be a little disciple putting up anemic little things in early Jacobean or late Cameron. What you'll be, if only I could live to see it.
You'll live to see it, and you know it now.
Cameron stood looking at the bare walls of his office, at the white piles of bills on his desk, at the sooty rain trickling slowly down the window panes.
I have no answer to give them, Howard. I'm leaving you to face them. You'll answer them. All of them, the Winand papers and what makes the Winand papers possible and what lies behind that. It's a strange mission to give you. I don't know what our answer is to be. I know only that there is an answer, and that you're holding it. That you're the answer, Howard. And someday you'll find the words for it.
Chapter 6 Sermons in Stone by Ellsworth M. Toohey was published in January of the year 1925. It had a fastidious jacket of midnight blue with plain silver letters and a silver pyramid in one corner. It was subtitled, Architecture for Everybody, and its success was sensational. It presented the entire history of architecture, from mud hut to skyscraper, in the terms of the man in the street, but it made these terms appear scientific. Its author stated in his preface that it was an attempt to bring architecture where it belongs, to the people. He stated further that he wished to see the average man think and speak of architecture as he speaks of baseball. He did not bore his readers with the technicalities of the five orders, the post and lintel, the flying buttress, or reinforced concrete. He filled his pages with homey accounts of the daily life of the Egyptian housekeeper, the Roman shoe cobbler, the mistress of Louis XIV, what they ate, how they washed, where they shopped, and what effect their buildings had upon their existence. But he gave his readers the impression that they were learning all they had to know about the five orders and the reinforced concrete. He gave his readers the impression that there were no problems, no achievements, no reaches of thought beyond the common daily routine of people nameless in the past as they were in the present, that science had no goal and no expression beyond its influence on this routine, that merely by living through their own obscure days, his readers were representing and achieving all the highest objectives of any civilization. His scientific precision was impeccable, and his erudition astounding. No one could refute him on the cooking utensils of Babylon or the doormats of Byzantium. He wrote with the flash and the color of a first-hand observer. He did not plod laboriously through the centuries. He danced, said the critics, down the road of the ages as a jester, a friend, and a prophet. He said that architecture was truly the greatest of the arts because it was anonymous, as all greatness. He said that the world had many famous buildings, but few renowned builders, which was as it should be, since no one man had ever created anything of importance in architecture, or elsewhere for that matter. The few whose names had lived were really impostors, expropriating the glory of the people as others expropriated its wealth. When we gaze at the magnificence of an ancient monument and ascribe its achievement to one man, we are guilty of spiritual embezzlement. We forget the army of craftsmen, unknown and unsung, who preceded him in the darkness of the ages, who toiled humbly. All heroism is humble, each contributing his small share to the common treasure of his time. A great building is not the private invention of some genius or other.
It is merely a condensation of the spirit of a people.
He explained that the decadence of architecture had come when private property replaced the communal spirit of the Middle Ages, and that the selfishness of individual owners, who built for no purpose save to satisfy their own bad taste, all claim to an individual taste is bad taste, had ruined the planned effect of cities. He demonstrated that there was no such thing as free will, since men's creative impulses were determined, as all else, by the economic structure of the epoch in which they lived. He expressed admiration for all the great historical styles, but admonished against their wanton mixture. He dismissed modern architecture, stating that, so far, it has represented nothing but the whim of isolated individuals, has borne no relation to any great spontaneous mass movement, and as such, is of no consequence. He predicted a better world to come, where all men would be brothers, and their buildings would become harmonious and all alike, in the great tradition of Greece, the mother of democracy. When he wrote this, he managed to convey, with no tangible break in the detached calm of his style, that the words now seen in ordered print had been blurred in manuscript by a hand unsteady with emotion. He called upon architects to abandon their selfish quest for individual glory and dedicate themselves to the embodiment of the mood of their people. Architects are servants, not leaders. They are not to assert their little egos, but to express the soul of their country and the rhythm of their time. They are not to follow the delusions of their personal fancy, but to seek the common denominator which will bring their work close to the heart of the masses. Architects, my friends, theirs is not to reason why. Theirs is not to command, but to be commanded. The advertisements for Sermons in Stone carried quotations from critics. Magnificent. A stupendous achievement. Unequaled in all art history. Your chance to get acquainted with a charming man and a profound thinker. Mandatory reading for anyone aspiring to the title of intellectual. There seemed to be a great many aspiring to that title. Readers acquired erudition without study, authority without cost, judgment without effort. It was pleasant to look at buildings and criticize them with a professional manner and with the memory of page 439, to hold artistic discussions and exchange the same sentences from the same paragraphs. In distinguished drawing rooms, one could soon hear it said, "Architecture. Oh, yes, Ellsworth Tuohy." According to his principles, Ellsworth M. Tuohy listed no architect by name in the text of his book. The myth-building, hero-worshipping method of historical research has always been obnoxious to me. The names appeared only in footnotes. Several of these referred to Guy Francon, who has a tendency to the over-ornate, but must be commended for his loyalty to the strict tradition of classicism. One note referred to Henry Cameron, prominent once as one of the fathers of the so-called modern school of architecture, and relegated since to a well-deserved oblivion. Vox populi, vox Dei. In February of 1925, Henry Cameron retired from practice. For a year he had known that the day would come. He had not spoken of it to Rourke, but they both knew, and went on, expecting nothing save to go on as long as it was still possible. A few commissions had dribbled into their office in the past year. Country cottages, garages, remodeling of old buildings. They took anything. But the drops stopped. The pipes were dry. The water had been turned off by a society to whom Cameron had never paid his bill. Simpson and the old man in the reception room had been dismissed long ago. Only Rourke remained, to sit still through the winter evenings and look at Cameron's body slumped over his desk, arms flung out, head on arms, a bottle glistening under the lamp. Then one day in February, when Cameron had touched no alcohol for weeks, he reached for a book on a shelf and collapsed at Rourke's feet, suddenly, simply, finally. Rourke took him home, and the doctor stated that an attempt to leave his bed would be all the death sentence Cameron needed. Cameron knew it. He lay still on his pillow, his hands dropped obediently, one at each side of his body, his eyes unblinking and empty. Then he said,
"You'll close the office for me, Howard, will you?"
"Yes," said Rourke. Cameron closed his eyes and would say nothing else. And Rourke sat all night by his bed, not knowing whether the old man slept or not. A sister of Cameron's appeared from somewhere in New Jersey. She was a meek little old lady with white hair, trembling hands, and a face one could never remember, quiet, resigned, and gently hopeless. She had a meager little income, and she assumed the responsibility of taking her brother to her home in New Jersey. She had never married, and had no one else in the world. She was neither glad nor sorry of the burden. She had lost all capacity for emotion many years ago. On the day of his departure, Cameron handed to Rourke a letter he had written in the night, written painfully, an old drawing board on his knees, a pillow propping his back. The letter was addressed to a prominent architect. It was Rourke's introduction to a job. Rourke read it, and, looking at Cameron, knotted his own hands, tore the letter across, folded the pieces, and tore it again.
"No," said Rourke. "You're not going to ask them for anything. Don't worry about me."
Cameron nodded and kept silent for a long time. Then he said,
"You'll close up the office, Howard. You'll let them keep the furniture for their rent, but you'll take the drawing that's on the wall in my room there and you'll ship it to me. Only that. You'll burn everything else. All the papers, the files, the drawings, the contracts. Everything."
"Yes," said Rourke.
Miss Cameron came with the orderlies and the stretcher, and they rode in an ambulance to the ferry. At the entrance to the ferry, Cameron said to Rourke,
"You're going back now," he added. "You'll come to see me, Howard. Not too often."
Rourke turned and walked away, while they were carrying Cameron to the pier. It was a gray morning, and there was the cold, rotting smell of the sea in the air. A gull dipped low over the street, gray like a floating piece of newspaper, against a corner of damp, streaked stone. That evening Rourke went to Cameron's closed office. He did not turn on the lights. He made a fire in the Franklin heater in Cameron's room, and emptied drawer after drawer into the fire, not looking down at them. The papers rustled dryly in the silence. A thin odor of mold rose through the dark room, and the fire hissed, crackling, leaping in bright streaks. At times a white flake with charred edges would flutter out of the flames. He pushed it back with the end of a steel ruler. These were the drawings of Cameron's famous buildings, and of buildings unbuilt. There were blueprints with the thin white lines that were girders still standing somewhere. There were contracts with famous signatures. And at times, from out of the red glow, there flashed a sum of seven figures written on yellowed paper, flashed and went down in a thin burst of sparks. From among the letters in an old folder, a newspaper clipping fluttered to the floor. Rourke picked it up. It was dry, brittle, and yellow, and it broke at the folds in his fingers. It was an interview given by Henry Cameron, dated May 7, 1892. It said, "Architecture is not a business, not a career, but a crusade and a consecration to a joy that justifies the existence of the earth." He dropped the clipping into the fire and reached for another folder. He gathered every stub of pencil from Cameron's desk and threw them in also. He stood over the heater. He did not move. He did not look down. He felt the movement of the glow, a faint shudder at the edge of his vision. He looked at the drawing of the skyscraper that had never been built, hanging on the wall before him.